Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
I am delighted to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Manuel Perez Rocha, who is an associate fellow, as so many great people seem to be, at IPS, the Institute for Policy Studies. Manuel is also the coordinator of the Network for Justice in Global Investment. He has published a number of terrific articles I've been reading over at truthout.org, and he has been working for some 15 years on the problem that goes by the name of NAFTA. Manuel Perez Rocha, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you very much, David.
So NAFTA is about to turn 20 years old. What is your assessment of the good or harm it has done to the three nations involved?
Well, the assessment is that it's done good and it's done bad, depending from where you see it. It's done good for big corporations and for the owners of those big corporations, of course, but it's done bad for workers and people that work from the land, you know, peasants and small rural entities and units, and it's done bad for the environment and in general for the working population. Now that NAFTA is going to become 20 years old, the governments of the three countries are starting to say loudly again how NAFTA has been beneficial in terms of the increase of trade and investment. But these are just very cold figures, very cold numbers. The increase of trade and investment has not trickled down as it was promised when NAFTA was being negotiated. The trade and investment has not trickled down. The benefits haven't trickled down to the people, to the population, to the working population, but have been concentrated more and more by the big corporations that have benefited from this trade pact. They have benefited mainly by the capacity or possibility to what we consider dislocation, that is, moving their production to areas or regions where they can produce in better terms for their profits. No? So NAFTA has been very good for example, U.S. car makers, automobile makers, to move into Mexico to make use of all profit from lower salaries, dramatically lower salaries of the Mexican working force, and to the detriment of the United States workers. So in general, this is the picture, no?
And is this true across Canada, the United States, and Mexico? A lot of people tend to think that if a treaty has hurt one country, it must have benefited the other country. It sounds like you're saying it's been bad for all three nations involved.
It's been bad for three nations involved because where you could argue that NAFTA might have benefited Mexico in terms of creating some jobs at the manufacturing sector, these jobs have, in general, have been very not permanent jobs, you know. Most of the manufacturing sector that has located in Mexico is under the maquiladora model, which is a model that allows companies to come in and get out of the country as soon as they want. And Mexico has suffered of a very unstable investment. It received a lot of investment in the manufacturing sector in the 90s, but then in the 2000s, a lot of maquiladoras, most of the maquiladoras, moved out to China and left a vacuum behind and joblessness in Mexico. And this was the story of the 2000s. I mean, of the last decade. A lot of maquiladoras are coming back to Mexico now because wages in China are rising and to make use of lower salaries in Mexico. But again, the jobs are not permanent. They're informal jobs that people don't get any benefits. They are highly exploitative jobs that make use of very low wages. And they people that work on this maquiladora industry do not have any security, no? And in terms of the manufacturing, more established manufacturing sector like cars, it's not like they employ a lot of people. I mean, there are thousands of works under the automobile industry that do not represent a big boom for employment in Mexico. Most of Mexico's employment is underemployment condition. In general, Mexico suffered a lot from the dumping of corn and grain and all the agricultural sector in Mexico, all the rural livelihoods were drastically impacted by NAFTA since NAFTA was implemented. And this was one of the main causes of migration to the United States. Because when NAFTA was negotiated, there was a promise that Mexico would industrialize and modernize, and this didn't happen as it was promised. So most of the jobs, or most of the livelihoods that were lost in the countryside, instead of coming to the cities in Mexico to look for employment in the industries and the manufacturing sector, they had in the end, they needed to migrate to the United States to look for jobs. So there is a it's never been a win-win situation, but the destruction of livelihoods, both in the United States and in Mexico, have been, have gone unintended.
We do hear from cheerleaders for NAFTA that it has created a middle class in Mexico and made people wealthy or at least reasonably well off in Mexico. But from what you've written, wages are actually lower than China, and some 50% of the workforce is in informal sorts of work, selling things on the street and so forth. What is the truth here?
Yeah, as I've written, despite the devastating drug war that Mexico has gone through and that is well known here in the United States, the spin doctors and the mainstream media and outlets like the Washington Post have repeatedly reported that Mexico has become a middle-class society. You know? Establishment people like economists like Thomas Friedman have said that Mexico is now one of the more dominant economic powers in the 21st century, and such. But this is a spin that I consider is based on very superficial assumptions. The small signs of economic recovery in Mexico that were present at the beginning of this year, but not now, even now, it is clear that Mexico is not going to grow as they were expecting at the beginning of the year. These assumptions are grounded largely, as I said, on the return of the maquiladora factories from China, where wages have been increasing as Mexican wages continue to stagnate. And at the same time, there is a middle class in Mexico that at some point it has been burgeoning or progressing, but it's not a majority of the population. I mean, indicators from the government of Mexico itself this year demonstrated that the middle class is a minority in Mexico and that most of Mexicans, around 60%, are situated in the lower class. And I'm defining those terms because those are the official terms that the Mexican government have used. Lower class, which means, of course, working class that do not achieve to have the most of the basic needs to live, no? Including enough food. There is in Mexico a very ongoing problem of malnutrition and people even starving. There are around 10,000 people per year that starve in Mexico. The myth of the middle class, it's somehow been spinned to try to say that NAFTA has been a success. And it is based almost on consumption patterns. This is what we have to understand. When you define middle class, it is defined by consumption patterns, and not so much as patterns of production. When NAFTA was negotiated, and the promise was that Mexico was going to become more productive, and Mexicans would become more productive as well, and we would be able to export more from our own production to the United States and other countries. But what happened was the contrary, that Mexico imports more and more, and in terms of consumption and nutrition, Mexico has become dependent on the United States, and not only for basic products like corn and beans, but also in terms of who distributes food in Mexico. So the main distributor in Mexico now of food is, of course, Walmart. And also you have all the other big companies like Costco and Sam's, etc. And this is what even the Washington Post in one article applauded, that Mexican consumers are now more able to choose for more products, because now they can buy more products from the United States. Even, and I quote in an article, corn chips, tortillas, and salsas. So this is very clearly a demonstration of how Mexico has become more and more dependent on the United States, and Mexican exports are much more dependent on the economy of the United States. But these are not Mexican exports. These are exports of U.S. companies that come to locate in Mexico to exploit cheap labor and then export to the United States with very little national content, Mexican content. So this is the problem of Mexico. I think it's becoming more and more some kind of colony of the United States.
We are speaking with Manuel Perez Rocha, who is an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Manuel, there's a great debate brewing in the United States about what to do about immigrants. And of course, under President Obama, we've seen record levels of deportation of immigrants. But you've suggested in your writing that few are asking the question, where do the immigrants come from and why do they migrate? And you point to not just NAFTA, but the DR-CAFTA. Maybe you should tell people what that is, and the IMF and the World Bank and other U.S. policies as generating the immigration in the first place. Can you explain that?
Yes. Well, the DR-CAFTA is the Dominican Republic and Central American Free Trade Agreement. And it's an agreement that that was signed with the Central American countries and the Dominican Republic, and it was completely modeled under NAFTA rules, by which the so-called barriers to trade were eliminated, which means that all the tariffs were brought down, but also it implies the creation of protections to investors, by which investors can move their goods, their services, and their finance, their money, their finances, the capital, freely and without any delay in and out of a country. To talk about other aspects that these free trade agreements have, no? So CAFTA was created in the 90s, and it has also created a grave crisis, social economic crisis, in the countries of Central America. And this has been very clearly a cause of an increase of migration from Central American countries to the United States. I mean, Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala, all these migrants pass through Mexico, and needless to say, through a journey of terror, a journey of horror, given the increase of criminal activity in Mexico and the extortion of migrants by the narco cartels. And CAFTA has been an increment of the NAFTA region. So what we've seen with NAFTA, which is Canada, Mexico, and the U.S., we now see the addition of Central American countries to this regime that gives everything to transnationals and disenfranchises people and disenfranchises governments from being able to implement responsible social economic policies, no? And also to promote local development. So this model of free trade is being expanded now, it's been expanded by the present administration of Obama through what is called the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which would be the largest free trade agreement so far. And it includes other countries of South America, like Chile and Peru, and several countries of Asia and Oceania, including Australia, Japan, Vietnam, and others. No? So despite despite Obama's promises during his campaign for presidency that he would overturn NAFTA and CAFTA and open them for renegotiation, so these free trade agreements would work for the working classes, as he said, and the working people, exactly the contrary has happened. There has been not one word of, after President Obama became president, there hasn't been one single word about changing NAFTA or CAFTA. On the contrary, he has applauded them, and the official position is to continue with the agreements as they are. But the president has opened up much larger negotiations of free trade agreements model under NAFTA with other countries, and then now we're still including. We're also seeing an agreement being negotiated with the European Union. So this free trade model is finally a product of this so-called Washington Consensus that was modeled, that was the model in the early, since the early 80s to implement changes, structural changes in countries so they could comply with paying their debts to the debtor countries, no? So this in basically the IMF and the World Bank, what they have done is these structural adjustment policies since the early 80s that have implied shrinking the state, shrinking government, and shrinking above all their capacity to implement policies that foment or promote local development. No? So it is shrinking their capacity to give subsidies to local production, to local and small farmers, and this is what happened in Mexico since the early 80s, much before NAFTA. Rural livelihoods were gravely affected by these policies because the Mexican government was obliged or forced by this World Bank IMF policies to constrain its capacity to help or to subsidize or to extend loans, for example, to small farmers. No? So in general, I mean, the neoliberal policy is to constrain the capacity of the government as much as possible to operate to benefit small productive units and small farmers, small and medium companies. And this is what has caused in Mexico such joblessness, such underemployment, that in the end has caused this massive migration to the United States.
I can remember back in 2008, an AFL-CIO sponsored debate for the Democratic primary presidential candidates. I think it was in a stadium. I think it may have been in Chicago. And I remember Congressman Dennis Kucinich promising that if elected president, he would immediately end NAFTA entirely on his first day in office. And I can remember just about all of the other candidates, maybe all of them, including Senator Obama, saying that they would dramatically reshape NAFTA. They would rewrite it to benefit workers and protect the natural environment and the rights to organize in the workplace. And everybody applauded. And of course, all the labor unions backed one or another of those candidates who promised that reform of NAFTA model. Once Obama was elected, am I understanding correctly that he hasn't lifted a finger whatsoever in that direction?
No, yeah, he didn't lift a finger, that's right. And I remember that when he was elected, we were very enthusiastic with people of the AFL-CIO and all the organizations we worked here in Washington about the possibility of starting a change, and we held a few meetings with some of the people working with him at the White House, but in the end nothing happened. And I remember that I helped to organize a letter to President Obama from a national campaign in Mexico called Without Corn, There Is No Country. That is a national campaign that is organized by all the small farmers organizations that try to protect Mexico's corn production and all their grains, because this is the basis of Mexico's nutrition system, corn and beans, etc. And that since NAFTA's dumping of corn from the United States has destroyed so many livelihoods. So we presented this letter to President Obama asking him, and I'm reading here, he would say, we, the people of Mexico, also want to renegotiate NAFTA to protect our corn, the jobs of millions of farmers, and the way of life in the Mexican countryside. And we were writing to asking for a new era of cooperation between the people of Mexico and the United States based on respect for our sovereignty, dignity, and the right to sustainable development. So we said we asked President Obama for a dialogue on NAFTA. And that dialogue hasn't happened at all. There hasn't been any dialogue. And it's been very disappointing, to say the least.
And there also hasn't been much visible opposition or protest from the labor movement in the United States in response to that lack of action, as far as I'm aware. What do you think, in addition to trade policies, is the impact on immigration of other U.S. policies, such as the drug war and drug criminalization, and military policies and support for a military coup in Honduras, for example? Are there other policies that the State Department and the Pentagon might change that would impact the immigration situation?
Well, I think the militarization of Mexico and Honduras and Central America in general have been one of the factors to deter migration to the United States. I mean, when you see also in the mainstream media comments about how migration has slowed down in the last couple of years or so, you see all sorts of absurd explanations, like Mexico's better off and it has better economic opportunities. This is frankly absurd. If you see the rampant poverty in Mexico and other Central American countries. But I think that the militarization, with the pretext of the drug wars, has the purpose of creating a climate of terror in our countries, in Mexico and Central America, that has in the end deter people that need to migrate from migrating, from moving northwards, because the situation in fact is that any migrant can be extorted, kidnapped, raped, or killed in any moment. So the traditional, let's say traditional lines or by which migrants would move north have been completely kind of destroyed, no? So migrants don't know anymore how to do it proper as they used to. It's like if you see a little line of ants moving from one point to another and you come and you stomp your feet, well, you will see how they are all confused and moving all about. You know? So this is what has happened with the militarization. I mean, it has created a very difficult conditions for people to move from one place to another because of the sheer terror that communities are living everywhere in Mexico and other Central American countries.
What about the poor state of the U.S. economy? Does it make the U.S. a less attractive place to desperately try to reach?
Yeah, that's I think that's certainly one factor. But I think as soon as the U.S. economy picks up, or not the U.S. economy in general, but you know, economies vary in the United States. There are depressed states like California, and others that are thriving like Texas. So you're seeing a lot of shifts in the migration patterns, even within the United States. California has depopulated in terms of migrants, and Texas is just thriving. And the causes of why Texas is thriving is interesting to note that a lot of Mexican capital has moved into Texas. This is another product of the war on drugs and the militarization, is that a lot of richer, you know, entrepreneurs and richer people in Mexico have moved, and especially people from the north, like from Monterrey, have moved their themselves personally and physically, but as well as their capitals from Monterrey, which used to be the most one of the most thriving local economies, local enclaves in Mexico, to Texas. Concretely San Antonio or Austin, that are flooded with Mexican capital as well. And so the migrants also have shifted in the United States, looking for the parts of the country that are more economically, doing better economically. No? So I think this will continue happening. I mean, the migration will continue as long as you have parts of the country that are doing better.
We're almost quickly running out of time. Briefly, what can you describe for people what the Network for Justice in Global Investment is, and what you do, and what your vision is for how our policies ought to look?
Yes. Well, the Network of Justice in Global Investment is an effort of citizens and organizations in several countries of Latin America and Europe, and where we want to our purpose is to challenge one of the most anti-democratic aspects of the global economic order, which are the rules governing international investment. These are rules that are found under free trade agreements and bilateral investment treaties by which corporations are given all sorts of privileges, including the privilege to sue a government directly in an international tribunal like the mainly the ICSID at the World Bank. The ICSID is the International Center for the Settlement of Investment Disputes. So if a government, just to cut it, the story short, if a corporation feels that it has been treated unfairly according to these investment rules, it can take a government to an international tribunal and sue for hundreds of millions of dollars. And this is also happening because of NAFTA. I mean, NAFTA, the investment chapter of NAFTA, the Chapter 11, it is the model that is being imposed through hundreds and even thousands of bilateral investment treaties around the world to grant corporations the investment protections that undermine the rights of nations and citizens to direct their own economic and environmental course. So I can give, I don't know if we have time, but I can give many examples of how corporations are making use of these rules to extort government, to handcuff them, and to handcuff them in terms of not allowing them to implement social, environmental policies or local economic promotion policies if they consider that those policies are affecting their profit in any manner. So it is a bit complex, it's very technical, but in a few words, these are rules that that are found in these trade agreements and investment treaties that give this special right to corporations, to transnationals, to bypass domestic courts and sue governments in an accountable international arbitration tribunal, like here in Washington at the World Bank, when they feel that any policy of a government has hampered or hindered their profit.
So beyond corporate personhood to corporate nationhood, and of course the TPP would expand on that model, and we need to stop it. We've been speaking with Manuel Perez Rocha. He's an associate fellow at IPS and coordinator of the Network for Justice in Global Investment. Manuel, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
No, thank you, David. Thank you very much.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.